You're listening to the Mythgreen Podcast with your hosts, Oren Ashkenazi, Wes Matlock, and Chris Winkle. There was a castle by a waterfall with a pink and purple wall and a princess living there. She had no parents and was all alone. She got by on her own and she liked it pretty well. Cause she never wore socks, she had a pet snake, she bought a red guitar.
This episode was made possible by the support of our patron, Kathy Ferguson, professor of political theory in Star Trek.
Welcome everyone to another episode of Mythgreen's Podcast. I'm Oren, with me today is...
Chris.
And joining us once again is Sarah.
Hello everyone.
And today's topic was actually Sarah's idea, so Sarah, why don't you explain what we're talking about today?
Okay, so the topic is, should you look past problematic elements in a show? Or maybe, what are you willing to look past? What makes it worth liking a show that has problematic elements in it? Or show, book, series.
Story.
Piece of media. I don't ever look past any of it. I only watch perfect, ideologically pure media. That is all that I consume. And if you say anything I consume is not pure, I will fight you.
So you stare at like a blank wall all day?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. That's the way I do it.
Yeah, he has like a media shelf that's just like empty.
There's just nothing
like
up
his
there.
Collection. He's very proud of it.
It's like a modern art piece that I'm working on.
So I think it's worth just talking about the problem with this is that trying to be objective about the things that we like is so very, very tough. And definitely one thing in my time at Mythgreens that I have learned and noticed is that there's kind of a feedback loop that happens with anybody who consumes something where if you start, like it's, say it's a story, you start reading the story. If you don't like something, you know, like maybe right away you run into something problematic, then that affects the way that you interpret the rest of the piece. And you're going to judge everything else harsher than you would otherwise. Whereas if you like something, that also creates a feedback loop where suddenly you're giving everything the benefit of the doubt and kind of self-reinforces. And, you know, with fans, this is just very true where I've gotten... One of the reasons I don't get into the comments section so much anymore and I never argue with somebody who disagrees with me is I've run into a number of people who are at the point where I don't feel like they can have a discussion with me in good faith anymore, even if they intended to, because they're going to interpret everything I say in the most negative light possible. And so with this kind of thing, there's a certain level of like, how much is it even possible for us to actually make... you know, objective judgments about what media is good enough or not good enough, you know, continue watching, even though we know it has problems.
It seems like a really personal thing. Like, this comes up a lot with, you know, when we find out that the creator of some media is a terrible human being, some people want to keep liking the things, you know. I guess there's a couple of reactions. One is to keep liking the things that they had that based entirely on the merits of the piece of art and not the creator. Other people make a line saying the things that they enjoyed before knowing this fact, they'll keep enjoying. And other people, it's like it's tainted. All of those things are now tainted, knowing that this person put themselves into this piece of media, and that person is, you know, has like tainted that piece of media now.
Mm-hmm. I will say that I felt very glad that I did a critique of The Sword of Truth without knowing anything about Terry Goodkind.
Oh, that's amazing.
Like, you know, so I just did not, I mean, I probably heard things before, but had not really associated it with the name. And so it's like, okay, I gave that, you know, a untainted, because I've read interviews with him later and it would have just been impossible for me to not let some responses to hearing what he said, you know, in my critique of his work.
There's like one of his books is like literally Atlas Shrugged. Like the plot line is just like mini Atlas Shrugged. And I didn't even know anything about his politics, but reading that book, I was like, wait a second.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I just did the first chapter of Sword of Truth. The first chapter of his first book in the series.
Nice.
So it looks, at least at that level, just like a typical, you know, fantasy, medieval fantasy written by a guy.
Right. Yeah.
And I mean, like, Terry Goodkind is not a super difficult example, because in addition to being a really bad person, his writing is bad. Like, it's not like, you know, we were like, we love Terry Goodkind's books, The Sword of Truth are so amazing, and then we found out he was terrible, right? They're not well written, they're bad. There are much better fantasy books out there. Like, even if you only read fantasy books from the middle-aged white dude author demographic, there are much better options out there. I would, you know, Wheel of Time is better than The Sword of Truth, and I'm a big critic of Wheel of Time, right?
Mm-hmm. We do not choose the terrible books we read in high school and get ridiculously attached to.
This is true. We did not make that choice. Mm-hmm. See, like, I'm a big fan of the concept that the author is dead, so...
Kill the author?
Yeah, I mean, kill the author if you have to. But, like, no. So, like, finding out for me that an author is a terrible person and has terrible views, that doesn't, like, go back and retroactively insert those views into a piece of media that they already that I've already, like, consumed. Like, if I've consumed it critically, which I try to consume everything critically, and I couldn't see it before, if I go back and look for it and suddenly see it, I'm probably just adding it in. It probably wasn't there to begin with. Unless, of course, I've, like, you know, become a better critic over time. That can happen too, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, for me, it's like, you know, for example, finding out that Orson Scott Card is the worst person ever and, like, hates gay people doesn't suddenly make Ender's Game a homophobic book. But the other half of that is that I don't want to give Orson Scott Card any money, even though he's an author and therefore dead. But not actually. He's actually alive. That's the problem. See, that's why I will never buy another new copy of Ender's Game or ever encourage anybody else to, right? Because even though it's a great book, and the fact that Orson Scott Card is an awful human being doesn't make it not a good book, I would still be giving money to Orson Scott Card. And mm-hmm. I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
Right?
It's yeah. really tough with Orson Scott Card, too, because when I look at books on writing and writing advice, Orson Scott Card has some of the best writings on writing, you know? And I have to tell people, like, what is worth reading and what is not worth reading, you know? And at the same time, I do feel like when I'm, for instance, recommending stuff to our blog readers, I have a certain level of responsibility to, like, just let them decide and be like, you should know this book is good.
Yeah, disclaimer... The person involved, one of the, I mean, yeah. books is, I think, sometimes even easier. Other media, it's even easier to recommend because there's usually multiple people involved in the production of, like, a film or a TV show. Whereas, you know, books, it's kind of like, well, there's this one person.
Mm-hmm. Don't read Orson Scott's Card's book on characters, though. Just don't. It's really sexist. Just don't read it.
We'll give you bad advice.
It will give you bad advice. He has other good writings on the subject of writing, but just skip that one. So I wanted to bring up grading on a curve.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how much and in what ways do you think, like, grading a piece is on a curve is appropriate as opposed to just looking more strictly about what bad things it is or isn't doing? Like, for instance, the biggest example being old works, of course.
I mean, we're putting aside, I guess, the author thing for a minute and talking more about, like, what's in the work itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's put aside the author for a minute. We can return to that if you'd like to discuss it more. But, you know, like, how much does it matter if there are other... How a work is in comparison to other works that are similar to it in some ways as opposed to just looking at it by itself?
I feel like it kind of depends on... what the thing is that's the problem. Like, sometimes it's literary tropes where, you know, you just might not have women in the story because, you know, women don't go whaling. Moby Dick only has men in it. Or, like, I know Sherlock Holmes, one of my favorite literary series, also has some issues with women.
Has an entire woman.
No. The thing is, there are actually a lot of women in Sherlock Holmes, but like, there's sort of this, the attitudes aren't, I guess, exceptional for the time, but also there's a lot of, like, humanity, you know, despite the sort of tropes, like, Sherlock Holmes and Watson do show a lot of empathy towards women in the limited capacity of, like, the norms of the time. So, not that it gives that a pass, but it's almost like it's trying to push past the sort of, you know, meet or push past the limited norms. There's still, like, more humanity involved rather than actually pushing forth those, like, it, you know, totally making women, like, villainous or shrill or total victims all the time. Like, if there's no actual, like, thought involved about these characters, that just feels like lazy writing rather than, you know, like, you could say it's the times, but, like, it means that the writer just didn't think about, like, all of the elements in their story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I definitely judge newer works more harshly than older works, right? Like, I don't think that old works just get a free pass, but if a new work does something, it makes the same mistake that I see a work from 60 years ago making, it's like, you know, man, you really should have learned better by now, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, Star Trek Enterprise has a lot of the same sexism that you see in Star Trek the original series. And I will never tell anybody who is critiquing Star Trek the original series that they have to give it a pass because it was in the 60s, because that's reductive and terrible. But I will judge Enterprise 100 times more harshly for having those same problems in 2004, right? Like, they should have known better by then.
I mean, to some extent, that's, like, our idea of progress. And I think that holds for maybe, like, the last 50 years to 100 years. But at the same time, like, throughout every point in history, there have been people that are keenly aware of the humanity of a bunch of all people, right? It's, but sometimes it's hard to look past the sort of deeply ingrained values of the culture. And I guess that, to me, that's the distinction, is the person trying to do what they can in terms of what they're conscious of versus what's just bleeding through because, like, they haven't really analyzed that part of themselves. Mm-hmm. And it feels like Enterprise, just doesn't, like, it seems like it's in an environment where people are aware of these various tropes, and yet they perpetuate them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Enterprise definitely has a feel of, I just want to write a good old white boy show. Like, it's almost, like, willfully focused on white men is what it really feels.
Why are you making Star Trek then?
Who knows? Right. But, I mean, I think it is a good point to bring up the fact that when we... making the assumption that in the past is always just worse and has more problematic things than in the present, like, there is a certain extent of that, but it's not, there's a lot more variation in history than just assuming it's worse back then and better now. And I think a really good example is when you look at fairy tales and the different people who collected and told fairy tales. In particular, you can compare the Brothers Grimm, a pair of German nationalists, to Charles Perrault, who is French. And you can see that the Brothers Grimm are really misogynist and generally violent, and their stories are more misogynist and violent. Whereas Perrault had a classism issue. But, like, in his version, you know, think of the Disney Sleeping Beauty, where we have an unconscious, you know, princess who's being kissed by this prince. In the Perrault version, he kneels by her and she wakes up and then they have a 4-hour conversation.
Aww.
That is legitimately how it happens. Like, I'm not kidding. So assuming that it's always going to be bad because it's old, you know, is sort of giving things a pass that when they haven't earned it, because there were people who wrote better things back then.
Yeah.
You know, and or had different blind spots, and just history is just a little more complicated than that. I think I personally don't have as much struggle because I just don't like old things. I mean, or just, you know, like, I watched the original Ghostbusters a couple of years ago, and it was, you know, a very different experience than when I was younger. And, you know, I understand why it's still classic and why people are still attached to it, but I'm just disgusted by the amount of sexism that's in it, and I don't want to watch it. And I've, you know, just let it go. And I think for me, since I tend to, especially with movies, just don't, you know, just I cannot enjoy older stories. I just let them go.
Yeah, and I mean, I have like, you know, a complex equation in my head of like deciding, it's like, okay, is this, this thing has an element that I don't like, a problematic element of some sort. Am I going to consume it anyway? And it's like, then I have to calculate in its other qualities and like add in, does it have any positive social justice messages that I have to consider? Or, you know, is, how enjoyable is it? Is it like, is money that I spend on it going to a good or bad cause? And it's not a very consistent formula. It gives me different results sometimes. And, you know, obviously that, a lot of that comes from a place of privilege. There are a lot of things that could very well bother someone who is not a straight white guy that I just don't notice. And I try to notice them, but I'm never gonna see past all of that. But like, you know, for something like Annihilation, the movie, I was really upset that they decided to whitewash both the main characters, because the biologist is supposed to be an Asian woman and the psychologist is supposed to be Native American. And like, they decided to cast two white women in those roles, and it was like, that's really upsetting. And then the excuses they gave were even more ridiculous. And like, that just made it worse. But in the end, I decided to go see it anyway, because even with those problems, it's still a movie all about women. And if like, if it failed and did badly, the lesson Hollywood would get from it was not people were upset about whitewashing. The lesson they would get from it is that people don't like movies about women. Right. And so that was like, that was the calculus that I went through when I was deciding if I wanted to go see the movie or not.
I usually go for, is it the balance between, am I enjoying this piece of media versus how much am I distracted by the, you know, does something jump out as being particularly like homophobic or transphobic or sexist? And, you know, or if something that I know about the creators, or, you know, if a character is whitewashed or something, like if there's something there that's like distracting me. So every time I look at it, I'm like, you know, I can't actually enjoy what's here because I keep thinking about this other element that's happening. Maybe this is a good time to bring up Paddington.
Yeah, please. I'm very curious about that.
Okay, so this week I watched Paddington, which is a live-action comedy for children, but also has, I guess, a CGI bear. This is based on the illustrated children's book, and it's set in London. And Paddington comes from, quote-unquote, darkest Peru.
Oh, geez.
Okay. Yeah,
you know, the darkest one.
So the backstory is
that... Alternate universe Peru, maybe?
So it's actually, that part is intentional. It starts out with an explorer, you know, an old-timey explorer with a pith helmet. Mm. And he goes to, quote-unquote, darkest Peru and discovers these bears, and teaches them to speak English and enjoy marmalade. And he befriends them. Like, he's going to hunt them, but then he ends up befriending them. And he goes back and he says, "You're always welcome to London." So there's a big earthquake, and Paddington's aunt and uncle send him off to London. And so he gets to London and he's expecting everyone to be really friendly, because the one human they've interacted with, you know, had actually come around to being a friendly person. And he keeps introducing himself as being from darkest Peru, because that's what this explorer from the, whatever, 1930s, 1920s called it. And, of course, people are jerks. They don't want to interact with him. It's in this weird zone where, like, no one is really that bothered that he's a talking bear.
but he's from Peru.
But he's from Peru. Like, they basically, you know, like... our main family of protagonists walks by, and the dad is like, "Oh, you know, the bear just wants money, you know, just like sleep in the gutter somewhere." You know, they're basically treating Paddington as a homeless immigrant. Well, they decide to take him in, and, you know, they start to recognize like Paddington's value as a person. And it keeps going on, and ends up becoming this critique of colonialism and immigration, because they still have this suspicion, right? And that's the turning point, is when Paddington, the family ends up kicking out Paddington after, like, there's been one thing that Paddington can't explain. They're like, okay, well, you know, you're clearly no good after all.
Right.
And the villain in the whole thing is the explorer's daughter, who wants to, she is upset that her dad didn't get recognized because he wouldn't kill the bears and bring back a specimen. So her goal is to kill Paddington and like put him in the museum.
And this is a children's film.
It's a children's film. And the lesson, of course, sort of, you know, the dad at the end is like, you know, just because we're different doesn't mean like you can do this. Like, we love Paddington, even though he's different. And so it's very this like pro pro-unity message, and it's really great. It's like, it's really trying to take something problematic and really address it and in a really family-friendly manner, in kind of a crypto manner. But there's this one scene, they have to have a cross-dressing scene where the dad dresses up as a woman in order to get past some guards.
I'll put a laugh track in here because that's just very, very funny.
It's just innately hilarious. It's okay, so I like got to the scene, and at this point, you know, as you're saying, like, I had already been primed to like it because I saw that it was doing some really clever things. And then the scene comes up, and I'm just like tensed up, just like cringing, waiting for it to be over. And it didn't, it like didn't do anything. The worst that it got was like the guard, of course, thinks that he's really sexy as a woman. And
of course,
is totally sexist. And then it ends, and I'm just like, oh, thank God, just like move on, movie, keep on going. So, as a whole, I really enjoyed it, and I think it has a really valuable message, and there's just this one scene, and I feel like, you know, some people, that scene is going to ruin the movie for them.
Mm-hmm.
I just barely got past it.
Yeah, well, I have stopped watching shows because of repeated scenes like that, and that's, you know, very unfortunate, but...
I mean, I remember, like, when this first came out, I was listening to a bunch of, like, British news podcasts for whatever reason, and I know that, like, the British far right was really upset about this movie, so, like, anything that upsets the far right, like, I'm good with.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I also can't help but be a little disturbed at the premise of this movie that there are no humans in Peru who would have discovered these bears.
Oh, yeah, that's the other big problem, is that, like, everyone, all the other, like, human cast are all white.
Right. It's just kind of an unfixably problematic premise, is that if the bears are from Peru, like, people live in Peru.
But they're from darkest Peru.
Darkest Peru. I mean, maybe we could, like, make a version of it where they're from some fictional island or something.
Well, that's what I was saying, is, like, why does it have to be, even if the original story that the movie is based off of is in Peru, I don't know why that's in such an important detail that you can't just... I make up a place that doesn't have humans.
I actually think that like they made fictional. That They're, up. I don't think that was in the book. I don't remember it being.
Oh, really?
Maybe it is. I maybe just forgot that part.
I think a lot of stories that aim for that kind of commentary, the places where they tend to fail often are because they are too similar to something in real life.
Mm.
Basically, the further you can manage to make that commentary, but, like, keep it separate from what's going on in the real world, the easier it is to not, you know, make those kinds of mistakes.
Right.
But, yeah, I think for me personally, one thing that matters a lot, and I know it matters for other people, is, you know, storytellers can build up a certain amount of trust or cred, where if, you know that the storyteller is working really hard to have good messages in their work, then when they do fail, it's a lot easier to forgive them and move on. I think a really good example is Steven Universe. This obviously has lots of constructive messages. It does have a few places where it fails. It has a character that is, you know, feels very much like a parallel for an autistic child that is very negatively depicted. And I think that gets better later. And it has, you know, one episode where it feels like the message of the episode is that people have to forgive their abusers. And some other things like that. But at the same time, Steven Universe has done so much good, and everybody knows that Rebecca Sugar is really cares about the messaging, that it's easy, I think, a lot easier to just, like, keep watching Steven Universe, right? Whereas when we get the sense that, like, there isn't that level of trust, you know, that somebody, you know, especially when the maker of a show says inappropriate things in response to criticism, then it's a lot harder to do that.
Well, and it's also like, okay, I look at a piece of media and it's like, okay, this piece of media has made a mistake, some kind of problematic element that really bothers me. I have to look at it and be like, okay, it's important to me not to judge social justice oriented media unfairly, because I can end up in that space where it's like, oh man, Steven Universe, you had an episode where you kind of implied that abuse victims just need to forgive their abusers, and like, that's bad and I hate it. But like, also that message is everywhere in like almost all media, and like, if I just drew the line and I was like, I will not watch something that has this in it, it would be very hard to watch a lot of things. And so it would be weird, and I think kind of hypocritical of me, to say that I'm going to stop watching Steven Universe when I'm okay watching a bunch of other shows that don't have that same level of positive messaging that Steven Universe does.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like the buy-in, like, for something like with Rebecca Sugar and the creators of Steven Universe, you trust them, and you like, enter into the show with all your barriers down. You're just like, I trust you to not be terrible and not show terrible messages. Whereas another show, if it already has a lot of problematic things going on with it, you're kind of just like, I'm just gonna ride this out. So then you it doesn't bother you as much,
right? And I mean, like, I try to avoid it, but it's still there. I mean, I'm having that problem with The Good Place right now, which is a show that I love. It's a fantastic show. Without spoiling anything, the early episodes of season 2 have a bunch of jokes at the expense of a short guy who is short. And I'm like, that's bad. Making fun of short dudes is bad. You should not do that. But at the same time, it's like relatively minor compared to what most media does. And like, it hurts more coming from a show like The Good Place, which I was super invested in and was like, you know, you did so well. You were so good. And now why are you doing this, The Good Place?
I need like a special term for like disappointment mixed with anger that fans get. Because I think that, like, you know, definitely some of the storytellers I rage against the most are the ones that have disappointed me.
It's
right?
Just that gif of Kevin Sorbo going, disappointed!
Yeah, that one. I think a problematic fave for me, but that to me, the storyteller has enough cred that I keep going anyway, is the show The 100. And it's done a couple bad things. It had killed off a black character in season 1.
The only black character?
No. Luckily.
Ooh.
No. That's the thing, is that that's one of the reasons I kept going. But it was probably like one of the most important black characters, and it was just really disappointing. And then season 3, and this is the thing that it's known for doing wrong, is it had it buried a queer woman.
Stop doing that, media. So frustrating.
And it was a really, really, the other thing is a really central romance. It was a romance with the main character. And one of the reasons why I kept going is because I do think that Rosenberg, the showrunner, messed up. And that clearly should have done a little bit of homework on the situation, because one of the reasons it was a problem is it seemed very similar to the death of Tara and Buffy that made people so upset. They were very similar deaths. At the same time, I can see as a storyteller what had been done to try to mitigate the impact of this death. For one thing, the death happened because the actress had other commitments. So it wasn't that she came back for the end of the season, but she had another. She was booked with another. So you're giving me a skeptical face.
Yeah, I'm definitely doing the thing like, that doesn't excuse the way they did that in the
story.
No,
it doesn't.
I feel like fridging characters, like killing off a character to give another character motivation, almost never goes well.
Mm-hmm. Right. And
it's just kind of a cheap storytelling trick.
Well, I mean, we could get into a whole other conversation about... I don't think that it's the issue of ever killing a character to get another character motivation is a problem. I think the big problem is that it's always the character that is already underrepresented that is getting killed off. So there were some external factors, but they brought in an additional gay couple that season and, you know, tried to do things like they brought the same character, even though she was technically dead, back for a heroic appearance at the end of the season. And like, I could kind of see, like, it wasn't enough and it definitely messed up, but I could kind of see like what was trying to be done to make it better. And since the show has, I would say, is above the curve when it comes to having people of color and having queer characters, you know, I decided to just like forgive it and move on. But that's because I think it has enough cred in general. But lots of people were upset by that, and I wouldn't tell anybody who decided that it shouldn't be watched anymore that they were wrong. But that's kind of my problematic fave.
Yeah, and like just the, it, you know, admittedly, it's easier to look past these things in shows that are just more technically put together. It's like, you know, it's like I'm watching a show that's garbage, and then oh, there was a graphic sexual assault. I guess I'm done. No, no loss. But if it's like a show that's really good, and then I'm like, then you did that thing, and it's like, but it, you know, admittedly, I want to keep in consuming that piece of media, right? So, and that's like one of the reasons why if I see, encounter a critique of a show or any kind of media that I really like, I don't engage with it if I don't feel I have something other than nuh-uh to say. Even if I think the critique is wrong, because very often I find critiques that are wrong. It's the internet. There are 7 billion people on it, whatever. Maybe not that many, but you know. So I find a lot of critiques that I think are wrong, but like I try to avoid just like going and being like, no, this the critique you made of this show is inaccurate, because I'm not adding anything to the conversation when I do that. I'm just, you know, I might be right. Maybe they are wrong, or I could be acting out of a knee-jerk reaction, in which case I just made myself, you know, look bad. Why would I want that? So, you know, if I see that, I just kind of like, okay, just keep on scrolling. You know, don't need to interact with that. That's somebody's got an idea, and they might be right or they might not be.
It took me like several weeks after watching Fury Road before I was willing to engage in like critical assessment of it, but just because I loved it so much and I needed to give myself time to just enjoy it, you know? And I feel like sometimes that's like, you just need to like, if you haven't noticed something in the process of watching it or reading it, you know, maybe give yourself a chance to enjoy it a little bit.
All right. Well, speaking of that, speaking of having enough time to enjoy things, we are out of time for this episode. Thank you for suggesting this topic, Sarah. It was quite good.
Yeah. Thanks for doing a podcast on it.
Yeah. Those of you at home, if anything we said piqued your interests, you can leave a comment on the website at mythgreens.com. Otherwise, we will talk to you next week.
If you enjoyed this episode, consider leaving us a review on iTunes so we can continue to grow like a swarm of nanites. There was a dragon with a pointy tail. He was bigger than a whale, and his breath was terrible. He scared the princess when he came around. Tried to burn the castle down, but she caught him by his tail. Then she tied him to a tree so the dragon couldn't fly. She told him he was mean, and it made the dragon cry. When he finally apologized, she offered him some tea. He accepted it graciously. Now he visits every weekend with the princess.
This has been the Mythgreant Podcast, opening closing theme, The Princess Who Saved Herself, by Jonathan Coulton.